Be a Classic with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 28th episode of Robots. In today's show, we dive into the world of celebrity robots with expert Fred Barton, known by most as Robot Man. His job is to do what many of us only dream about. He makes the official studio-licensed collectibles of many of your favorite Hollywood robots, including Robbie the Robot, R2-D2, Cylons, and Gort.
We'd love to hear about your own favorite Hollywood robots, so don't miss our competition this week for a chance to win a sci-fi DVD or Blu-ray of your choice. But first, as always, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. The Israeli Defense Ministry has demonstrated a robot snake capable of recording video and sound on the battlefield. The snake robot is about 2 meters long and covered in military camouflage. To date, few technical details of the snake have been released, but a video by Israel's Channel 2 TV station shows a soldier controlling the robot via a laptop while it flips and rolls through rough terrain and lifts its front to see over obstacles and captures video through its head camera. The Israeli military plans to use the new robot to find people buried under collapsed buildings, to conduct reconnaissance, or to carry explosives. Last week's International Food Machinery and Technology Expo in Tokyo may not be the most likely place to find lots of robots, especially not humanoids. But Japanese engineers have high hopes for a new brand of hospitality robot. This is why prototype robots were seen in the expo, flipping pancakes, cutting vegetables, serving drinks, feeding people, and moving sushi between plates. As one robot spokesman puts it, using an android to cook isn't very practical, but it shows what robots can do with the right programming. California-based robotics company Willow Garage, which is well known for their ongoing work on an open-source robotics platform, has reached milestone 2 of their program. Their PR2 robot successfully navigated a dynamic office environment riddled with people. It took the PR2 less than 1 hour to autonomously plug itself into 10 designated power outlets throughout the building, navigated hallways, and opened doors in the process. The robot also detected that one of its 10 goal outlets was behind a locked door, aborted the effort, and moved on to its next outlet. A crucial element in achieving this milestone was the PR2's new failure handling system, which allowed it to recover from errors in detecting doors and grasping plugs. For more information on the military snake robot, the Japanese hospitality robot, or the PR2 navigating robot, check out our website at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Robot Man, whose real name is Fred Barton, is the best embodiment of a sci-fi passionate and expert. From his first construction of Robbie the Robot when he was a teenager, Barton grew up to become the most renowned maker of life-size celebrity robot collectibles licensed by Hollywood studios. His robots can be found around the world in museums and the homes of his fellow sci-fi enthusiasts. He's been widely present in the media, including The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and is a member of the Robot Hall of Fame jury, Hall of Fame which actually includes the one and only Robbie the Robot.
Hi Fred, welcome to Robots.
Well, hello, it's very nice to be here.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Well, sure. I guess I'm pretty much known as Fred Barton, the Robot Man. And the Robot Man was a nickname that someone gave me in high school. They would see me coming down the hallway and they go, "Oh, there's Fred Barton, the Robot Man." And it just kind of stuck, and I guess I was called the Robot Man because of my interest in famous movie robots and robotics in general, and particularly my interest in Robbie the Robot. And I was fortunate enough, really, at the age of 17 in high school to actually restore the original robot for a museum in Buena Park called Movie World, Cars of the Stars, Planes of Fame. And they had acquired Robbie at a motion picture auction from MGM in 1970 when MGM was going into the Vegas casino business. They were selling a lot of their movie props, and they were shutting down their film lots out here in Culver City. And Robbie was sold to this museum where he was on display, and I really happened upon him and saw him in person for the first time, and I thought, well, this is just incredible. And I said, I've got to have one. You know, I've always wanted a Robbie the Robot, you know, I mean, not just a little 12-inch toy that my parents would get me for my birthday, but, you know, this is something that I really wanted. I wanted a 7-foot prop, and really the only way that I was ever going to get one was to make it myself. And I never really had any experience in model making, much less making a full-size robot. So it was really a great aid in having the robot actually in front of me at this museum. And I was able to go there on weekends and so forth and take measurements and pictures. And eventually, over the course of a year, I had built my own Robbie the Robot, which later I had taken back to that museum to show them. You know, by now they had known me quite a bit. I would be there all the time looking at this robot. And then one day I brought my robot there and walked it around, and they really thought that I had done something with their display when it turned out just to be my robot. And the owner of the museum was so impressed, he asked me to restore the original to make it, you know, back in his glory days, because he had really been quite vandalized, and souvenir hunters were taking parts of him, and the studios had ravaged him over the years. And I was actually able to fulfill the dream of even having the original Robbie, even though it was only for a few months to restore it, but it was still really a thrill to be able to get that. And that was really my introduction into robotics. Besides just being a fan, it was actually getting the opportunity to get the original robot home and see how MGM had made it and so forth. It was a great experience.
Maybe for those who don't know, who is Robbie the Robot?
Okay, Robbie the Robot is a robot that was made for the 1956 film Forbidden Planet. Now, believe it or not, Robbie really set the stage for modern science fiction and robotics in general, all the way to the movies we're even seeing today, you know, through Terminator and all these other films. Robbie made it possible for a general public to accept robotics and artificial intelligence as the future way of life, which is, of course, really where we are headed. I mean, if you look at the iRobot film with, you know, Will Smith and so forth, Robbie is a very robot-looking robot, however. He doesn't look like a person like Data in Star Trek or something. He looks like an old washing machine, kind of a 50s vacuum tube kind of thing. But he's really kind of like the Mr. Belvedere of outer space. He's got this great personality. He doesn't sound like a robot. You know, he has a really great speaking voice. And he was designed by a draftsman named Robert Kinoshita, who is actually 95 years old right now, and he is still bowling. But he actually designed Robbie and the Lost in Space robot as well. And these are really two of the most famous robots within science fiction circles. I mean, matter of fact, Forbidden Planet and Robbie the Robot are so popular, they're planning a trilogy right now, directed by Jim Cameron and produced by Joel Silver and written by the guy who wrote Babylon 5, and it's going to be a three-film epic, paying tribute to the original Forbidden Planet and probably reintroducing Robbie the Robot in general, and it's something I hope to be very closely involved with. But that's basically Robbie's history. He was a robot introduced in 1956, and he went on to do a lot of television shows after that. He was in The Twilight Zone and The Addams Family, some episodes of Lost in Space, and he did Mork and Mindy. We did an episode of Clueless and Love Boat, and we just did an AT&T commercial. I mean, Robbie is the first movie prop to go on and be actually a mechanical movie star, a personality, if you will. Unlike other props and movies, you know, they're just used for a few weeks, that's it. Robbie has actually had a 50-year career in movies and television, which is really unprecedented. As a matter of fact, Robbie was the first robot or movie prop, if you will, to get a credit in the main title of the movie. It'll say Forbidden Planet in the beginning of the film, and then it will say, and introducing Robbie the Robot, right along with all the other co-stars' names and so forth, which is, you know, really unprecedented. I mean, it hasn't been done before or since, and it just shows you how MGM felt about Robbie and his potential and where it's gone on today. It even brought about the modern age of movie licensing rights for merchandise and collectibles. I mean, Robbie was such a hit that they started making little tin toys and so forth right after the film, and heretofore there were never really any movie collectibles. Now it's a very common thing. I mean, you'll go to Burger King or something and you'll get a Wolverine something or other, but back then there was no such thing. There were no movie tie-ins with merchandising, and really Forbidden Planet and Robbie the Robot started all that, and it's become a multi-billion dollar industry.
Why did everyone love Robbie? Is it because it was the first robot in the cinema, or was it because of the character of the robot?
Well, Robbie wasn't the first robot in cinema. He was the first ultra-sophisticated robot in cinema. We had other robots. We had Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still, and he was kind of a big police kind of guy, policeman. He didn't talk, and he had a very ominous presence, and that was in 1951. But prior to that, we had a lot of movie serial robots, there was another robot named Gort, besides the Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still, from the mysterious Dr. Satan, and he looked like a walking water heater, a very, very primitive cardboard-looking robot, just painted silver with a bunch of rivets put on him. Kind of iconic and very retro in its own way. Of course, that was from the 40s. And then in 1954, we had Tobor the Great, also from a Republic serial, also very tin-looking robot. And really, even earlier, back in Germany, Fritz Lang was making Metropolis in the late 20s. And he had a very Art Deco, very, very cool robot named Maria. And she was really the inspiration for George Lucas to create C-3PO. If you look at the two robots side by side, you can see where Lucas had paid homage to Maria and that German Art Deco look. But we had about three or four or five other robots in cinema. You know, this is actually, if you look at it, I mean, I think we've had movie robots for really the last 80 years. And it really even goes back to another biblical kind of thing called the golem, which was also a man-made created being, which they were considered the first robot in cinema. That was in the silent era, well, as was Metropolis. And I think robots have really come a long way. I mean, I think they're just very well received these days, and people just take them for granted, as opposed to it being a new concept. But I mean, that's the way any kind of technology creeps into the, you know, main consciousness of the people, and becomes an everyday item, like an iPod. I mean, who would think that we would have such, you know, great amount of memory in these little tiny computers and our iPhones and iPods and so forth? But now it's really, you know, my 5-year-old has it and just takes it for absolute granted. Like, this is what it is. You know, so.
As a teenager building Robbie, did you find it difficult as an enterprise? What were the challenges?
Well, yeah, building Robbie was actually very, very difficult. It is a very complex thing to make. It took MGM, 6 months and over like $150,000 with their fantastic prop department building Robbie, much less a kid in high school who was trying to, trying to build a robot from scratch. I had to learn all these techniques and do a lot of things that I just couldn't afford. I mean, today is now my primary business. Of course, it's different. We can talk about manufacturing Robbie today as opposed to when I was a kid. But when I was a kid, I had to sculpt things out of clay. I had to turn things on a potter's wheel out of plaster. I had to make negative molds out of fiberglass. I had to make things shapes out of wood, figure out how things would go together, seam plastics, vacuum form plastics. It was just a lot of work. I was very fortunate to be in high school at the time and have all these different shop classes available, wood shop, metal shop, and I wouldn't have to do the regular, you know, toy box that the other kids were making, because I was working on this project, and the teachers would just let me work on whatever I wanted to, because they thought it was kind of a neat project to work on. And I did finish it, But it was difficult. I mean, I would have to make these homemade vacuum form machines, and I would go into my mother's kitchen, and believe me, she wasn't too thrilled with that, and melt plastic in the oven, and use a vacuum cleaner to create a suction, and then vacuum form parts and so forth right there, then trim them, then put them together and so forth. It was a very involved process, and it was a great learning curve for me, because I had no idea, and I employ many of these same techniques, you know, professionally now in my business, you know, so... It was good. I really started in the trenches and worked my way up in terms of manufacturing.
After this first experience as a robot maker, you sort of left it aside until 1996 when you decided to make celebrity robots for a living, basically. What was your motivation?
Well, you know, I had gone to school. I got a master's degree in film production, and I was doing some advertising writing for a company. And this was like 20 years later after I had built my first Robbie, you know, for the museum and so forth. And I was kind of getting interested in doing another robot. I thought Robbie should have his little brother, who was the Lost in Space robot. Remember, he was designed by the same guy. And I thought that somebody would want to have that. So I started researching that, and there really weren't any parts available or anything on that. And this is really what got me back into robotics, is that I just wanted to make another robot. I already had Robbie, and I was looking into making another robot. And nobody had anything, unlike today, where there's, you know, where I created kind of this robot empire for hobbyists and enthusiasts alike. But, you know, the internet was new, and people were logging on or getting on more and more. And you know how things get around on the internet, people started finding out about, oh, this guy built Robbie, oh, this guy's building a Lost in Space robot. You know, how interesting, how can I get involved with that? You know, I want one too. And I got a lot of that, like, I got a lot of those type of emails and so forth, and people would start talking and chatting, and the word would spread. And eventually I thought, and this is also when Planet Hollywood was becoming very popular in the late 90s, and when other collectibles were starting to get more popular, you know, the full-size collectibles like the Darth Vader type of foam thing, or the full-size alien creature, you could start getting these things. But they weren't very sophisticated, and they weren't very well made. You know, they were made out of foam, and they were painted and so forth. They were just kind of thrown together. And, you know, I just couldn't work that way. You know, Robbie deserved, you know, better. So what I did was I took all the parts and everything from my robot that I had made years previously, and I had also had the presence of mind to mold the entire Robbie the Robot when I had it, to, in case I had to do spare parts or for it for the museum. So I was able to take all those parts, and now with like money and much more knowledge behind me, I was able to retool and make this super fantastic, ultra sophisticated computer controlled, remote controlled Robbie the Robot, which I took to Warner Brothers, and I said, "Listen, I want to license this for sale for others." And it was really unprecedented. They had never really, no studio had ever licensed anybody to make a full-size movie prop of this magnitude and sophistication. But they went for it, and I've been licensed ever since. I mean, I've been, you know, I make a lot of robots under studio license. I do the Battlestar Galactica Cylons for Universal, and for instance, I'm doing R2 and 3PO now for Lucasfilm and Sideshow, which is available now. So it's really come a long way, you know, in terms of, but I think your original question, well, what was my motivation to do it for a living? Really, I had no intentions on doing it for a living. It kind of just got away from me. It got more and more popular. It took more and more of my time. And I started making parts and making these robots, and, you know, here it is, 13, 14 years later, and it's really going stronger than ever. I'm in museums all over the world. I'm in some of the finest homes and collections all over the world, and it's really taken off. I mean, people call me for, you know, interviews, or I'm kind of the Leonard Maltin of robots, as it were. You know, if people want to know about robots, they really come to me, or really about any information on most science fiction movie props. And pretty much the authority, because I was really a fan first of the genre. you know, sci-fi, and I just kind of got into this. And you meet people with similar interests, other studio professionals, and it's really been great because we all have the same interest, as do the people who collect my robots. You know, they could be a plumber or a brain surgeon. It doesn't matter. I've got all types, and everybody just has that same love of the genre and of these robots.
You have your company, Fred Barton Productions, which produces all these celebrity robots. Maybe just give us an overview of all these robots. You've already named a couple of them.
Well, yeah, right. You know, I've got really any movie robot you can think of, I have probably made in one form or another. The most popular robots are pretty much Robbie. He's still the king, even though he's been around 50 years. I mean, between everything that's going on with Forbidden Planet and Warner Brothers re-releasing the film, in high definition, and having a large premiere for that. So there's Robbie. There's Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still. I'm currently working on the classic RoboCop, and I'm going to be involved somewhat with a new RoboCop release, the RoboCop 2010. I'm in negotiations right now with MGM about some of that stuff. There's the Battlestar Galactica Cylons, both the classic and the new version of the Cylon. Now, what's interesting about the Cylon is that it was never a robot suit. Like, all these other robots were like a man inside wearing a robot suit, whereas the Galactica robot is a CG, a computer-generated character, which was very hard to translate into a real 3D statue that has electronics and has sounds and able to make that structure in real life, because you can do anything in a cartoon, but when you have to make it stand, you know, a 7-foot sculpture that, you know, from, you know, a super space age kind of thing is, it was a challenge. But I also did the silent running drones from the movie Silent Running, just a lot of other robots from obscure films, because there weren't really too many robot films, so it's kind of a finite group of celebrity robots. There's about 15, I'd say, that are most well-known. The T2 endoskeleton from the Terminator series. I think we mentioned the Lost in Space robot. I do Tobor the Great, and I do that other robot, Gort, from The Mysterious Dr. Satan. And I don't know, there's others. I can't think of them all at the top of my head, but I think those are the most popular robots that that I do. And I'm always looking to make some new robot. You know, if something is out there, like there's the new Gort for The Day of the Earth Stood Still. I don't know how well he'll translate into a, he was, I think, 40, 50 feet. I think we would make an 8-foot version of that. But, you know, the classic version is so great. It just seems to be, it kind of pales in comparison to the Robert Wise version.
You call your productions animatronic robot statues. Concretely, what can these robots do?
Well, they do much like the Disney robots, say, at Star Tours. You know, you'll see when you walk into Star Tours, you'll see R2 and 3PO standing there talking and moving, but not actually walking. Well, that's what a lot of my robots do. They'll stand there and talk and move, but they won't walk because, A, there's insurance limitations and the cost of making a robot walk these days or roll around is really prohibitive. And the average consumer doesn't really look or need or want that type of motion. But they do like, you know, moving parts, moving bodies and so forth. But they stand there in a secure spot, you know, usually in their home theater, their living room, or on display somewhere, wherever they want to put it. And the robot will stand there and talk and usually say some of the most famous lines that from whatever production that they were in. They're all pre-programmed to act exactly as they did in the show that they were in. Now, by animatronic, you know, that was a term coined by Disney back in the 60s when they were doing their Carousel of Progress and their Mr. Lincoln. They would call it audio animatronics, and the animatronic word just kind of stuck. And it just means like animation and electronics. So that just means electronics moving something that is animated. So when the motors turn on in my robots, they are microprocessor controlled to turn on and move, and then have the voice come up synchronized with it when it's supposed to be, like the Enchanted Tiki Room. All these things are just, you know, instead of having these huge, giant computers like Disney used to have, you know, we have these microprocessors now, and really very sophisticated electronics that are made specifically for my robots, and we do all our own electronic manufacturing and all our own proprietary software for this stuff, and have special motors and servos and mounts and so forth. And then we make the robots look like they did. I mean, it may be a robot that was made in 1956 or 1966, but inside he's as sophisticated as any theme park robot you'd see today, or display or really anything. I mean, whatever needs to be controlled, we could do it, and we do it really well and very efficiently, and the sound quality is 16-bit audio, stereo. It just sounds incredible. And you can even plug any of my robots into your home theater if you wanted the sound to come through your main speakers. You could do that, and it sounds just as good. I mean, absolutely just as good as any Blu-ray disc or a DVD soundtrack, because the technology we're using and the source of the audio, and we keep it very, very clean, and it's really nice to have.
What type of technical challenges are you faced with when building these robots, as opposed to when you were in high school, maybe?
Well, you know, in high school, I was completely technically challenged. I mean, you know, it was technically broke was really the number one thing. And we didn't have all the sophisticated memory chips and so forth that we had when I was in high school in the 70s. It was just starting, you know. And really, I kind of made a low-tech Robbie the Robot, because this was a costume. I mean, think that's what MGM did, too, in the 50s. They just made a suit that a man would get in, and just have motors in it. And that's pretty much what I did with my first robot. The challenge was, really, I wasn't too challenged in when I made my first robot, because I had no other choice but to do it as MGM did, when that was actually make the robot suit, make it so a man can go inside. And it really had no electronics, because it didn't need any. We would put a control panel inside the robot with switches, and if you had to turn on this gizmo, the man inside would turn the switch on. He had to turn on that gizmo, the man inside would turn on that switch. So that's really very, very basic electronics, or really electricity. It's almost like house wiring. It's just like a light bulb or a motor and a couple of switches. But later, you know, in the 90s, I my forte really isn't electronics, but my forte as a producer is to get the best people in the business to work for me, and tell me what is possible and what is not, what we can do and what we can't, and how much it would cost and so forth. So I would get the best software and hardware engineers in the business, and then we designed up. I would tell them what features I want, and then they would go away and they would come back with a circuit board that says, all right, this board will allow you to do, as opposed to a man turning on a switch, this computer board is going to do all the switching for you now, and it's going to, you know, you're going to be able to do things at variable speeds, you know, very various volumes. There's just a number of ways to store information. And actually, I recently went through a major redesign in all the robot electronics, because I was using these electronics from the 90s, and, you know, that just doesn't cut it anymore. So we went through a major redesign, and now we're really, really state-of-the-art right now with all our circuitry and everything, and I'm really very quite pleased with it. And it's also very user friendly. All you have to do is push a button, and Robbie starts up, and that's it. You could watch the show. Some of my earlier Robbies were a little bit more hands on, where I would have a remote control, and you were able to remotely turn his head left or right, or turn on this gizmo or that one. And I found that people were tired of just kind of, you know, having to control him all the time. They wanted to sit back and watch a show. They wanted to see Robbie perform, or whatever other robot I would do. And so I've made them what we call an audio animatronic, where they have a complete show. And they go through their show, and then they reset. And then they start doing their own thing. Their program, when they're done performing, they go into like a standby mode, where they just kind of move and do different things on their own. And it's never the same way twice, because they really have their own electronic brain. So it's really up to them what body part they want to move, or what or what little twirling thing they want they want to move, you know. And you got to remember, with these robots, these are what Hollywood art directors, you know, thought the future would look like, and they make all these little gizmos and stuff. They look great on film, but they don't necessarily, you know, and they are based in science to some degree, but not, you know, they're not necessarily functional, but they look good. And they're fun to control, and there were challenges. There were challenges in getting all the parts machined properly. You know, getting them all mounted. You know, I use this excellent machinist. Literally, the little old German machinist. He does very high precision stuff, and he makes me some incredible mechanisms that will just last forever.
This is crazy, but did you ever think of making sort of a theme park with the robots, which have maybe more intelligence or more autonomy, walking around, interacting with the people, with some?
Well, you know, in general, you know, I would love to. My forte is really pretty much movie robots. I mean, there are other companies that are doing that type of robotics. They're really still in their infancy, and they're very expensive. They're like small walking robots. They're usually about 12 inches tall. I mean, the best walking robot I've really seen is Asimo, but he is also, you know, requires a moving van worth of electronics and an entire crew, and you know, he's just barely able to walk, you know, walk down the hallway and hand you a newspaper. If you sneeze, he'll fall over. I mean, robotics isn't really, anywhere where we can make something that is, for the consumer. It is certainly in the future. I think they'll be walking and talking robots that can, to some extent, do some things at home for us. You know, honestly, you're still better off with a trained monkey or a dog to do something around your house than you will be with a robot. And it'll probably be that way probably for another 20, 30 years. I mean, as electronics get smaller and as batteries get smaller and more efficient, and some of the technology involved and materials get lighter and stronger, but all these things have to happen. We're certainly on the right track with face recognition and just everything. But you know, that's still, I'm not saying it's science fiction. It's really science fact. But we're still at the beginning of that, and that's going to be something more that my kids are going to be living with. Something more like we saw in iRobot. Even that, I mean, I think what they set that in 2030, I think we're looking more like 2070. So we're really going to have that kind of robotic interface in our lives. But it's fun to have these movie stars in your house in the meantime, you know. So it's somewhere between art and reality, I guess.
As you said at the beginning, you're really an expert in science fiction movies. How do you see the evolution of robotics in Hollywood movies over the years?
Well, really, it was kind of this natural evolution. You know, robots started out as mindless monsters, you know, henchmen kind of thing. Kind of like a really monsters. They were just a mechanical monster as opposed to a creature or an alien. It was a robot doing dirty work or so forth, especially in those early mobster type thing, or the Undersea Kingdom, or the Copperhead, or Commander Cody. All these serials, they would have robots as the villains or the bad guys, and they would walk, they wouldn't even talk, you know. And then, like I said, it really wasn't until Forbidden Planet and the introduction of Robbie, where Robbie was, here was this intelligent, talking, fully functional robot that was not only a sophisticated butler-type character. He was a mentor. He was a teacher. He had superhuman abilities. He had a razor-sharp mind and wit. He had, laser beam weapons and so forth, energy neutralizers, all kinds. You know, he was able to replicate matter in any shape or quantity. I mean, Robbie was just, you know, this for a 50s invention. I mean, we still don't have anything that can touch Robbie in today's technology. I mean, if it were real, really. After Robbie was introduced in film, people just took it for granted that, well, all robots should be able to do what Robbie the robot does. I mean, he started it all, you know, as I said earlier, but that was really the evolution. It kind of all started in one film, and in one robot in Forbidden Planet, and that really set the tone for Star Wars and Star Trek. I mean, Star Trek is completely modeled off of Forbidden Planet, the entire concept of it. And if there was no Forbidden Planet, you would not have seen movies like 2001, Star Wars, Star Trek, or any of the modern spinoffs. It all started with that, and we really owe a lot to MGM for coming out with it. This was their first big budget science fiction film. They had all of the great technicians that had worked on Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, and it was shot here in Culver City on all four of their sound stages in the 50s, and it was really the end of the era of the golden age of Hollywood and MGM, but they still had all their techs, and it shows. I mean, if you look at the art direction and the special effects and everything in Forbidden Planet and the sophistication. Although it was considered a B movie, what they mean by a B movie was like lower budget, or it didn't have like a bunch of their A-list movie stars. It still turned out to be, besides getting a cult following, I mean, it's still one of the biggest films that MGM has ever produced to date. I mean, in terms of what people remember from a studio, Forbidden Planet and Robbie the Robot is a milestone for them. And I think they're recognizing that now, and getting the Robbie and so forth are getting their due. And in general, robots have evolved into like Data on Star Trek. You know, we don't see any robots that look like robots anymore. Now they're looking like people. And to me, that's a cheat. I mean, that's not a robot. I mean, yeah, technically, okay, he's a robot. He's not alive. He's not a sentient, you know, organic matter, you know, that it's a simulation because it's, it's wires and so forth. But if they look like a person, I just have a hard time, you know, feeling that they're a robot, you know, because to me, a robot is something that has, you know, gears and shiny metal and blinking lights and so forth. I may be old-fashioned, but I think that's what makes it fun. And makes it neat and has an appeal for kids. I mean, you know, you show somebody Commander Data, it just looks like, you know, some guy's going out to a nightclub or something, you know, putting makeup on. It's crazy, you know. I like hard metal robots. You don't see any there's no confusion, there's no gender confusion in Star Wars. You know who's a robot and you know who's a villain or an alien. You know, there's no people-looking robots, you know, and I think that's the way it should be in cinema.
Mm-hmm. For the future, could you imagine a new type of robot in the cinema which would set a new standard, sort of like Robbie?
Well, I would hope to see one, or maybe be responsible for that one. Maybe it could be some kind of hybrid robot, but it's so hard to say what they're going to do with CG now. I think you'll probably see something, a combination of a CG and a person inside a costume kind of thing, and that might set a new standard. But, you know, that whole era, you know, it may be over. It may be to the point where there isn't a new wondrous thing because, you know, the age of wonder with these electronics may be gone because people expect so much, you know, just for granted, you know, like when I was talking about the, you know, so much memory being available in our small handheld computers, you know, the BlackBerry, iPods, and so forth, iPhones, you know, people just, you know, it's there. It's just like you pick up a telephone, you don't think it's any big deal. And I think there's been so much fantasy stuff, and there's so much on satellite and kids' cartoons and so forth, where you know, Jimmy Neutron and so forth, that where you see all these crazy robots and inventions and gadgets, that to bring something to the big screen as in terms of a new robot, unless it's so spectacular, I really think your new robot trend, it has to be story driven. It has to be a good drama, a good story, a good personality. Then even if it just looks like, you know, two vacuum tubes taped together, you know, you won't care how cheesy it is. If that's a likable character, it's going to be very popular. Whether it sets the stage for a new sense of technological wonder, you know, I don't know. I don't know if we could really recapture that wonder, you know, that age of innocence where everything was new. I mean, you know, can everything be new again? I mean, as generations change, I mean, there's always reappreciation of the old, but I think it's kept in perspective. I mean, these things are becoming museum pieces as opposed to, mainstream. So, you know, I'm hoping there is something, but I think it has to be a combination of a story and technology to really have a robot character that is endearing as Robbie and as Robbie is today. I don't know. I strongly urge all your listeners to go out and rent and buy Forbidden Planet, to just have a lot of fun, see an old retro sci-fi flick, but see what I'm talking about and see if you don't. I mean, sure, it's going to be dated and it's a little bit corny in the dialogue, but it's the 1950s. You have to get past that. Believe me, you know, you look at some of the films that are made in the 80s and 90s and you're going, you know, you're rolling your eyes now, you know. So nothing stays fresh forever, and people and kids get more and more sophisticated. But it doesn't mean we should give up, you know, our past and our roots for our past, because I think that's what will help us, you know, build a new and reimagined future. And that's another word that I don't really particularly care for, is reimagine. You know, all the studios are taking these classic films, and rightfully or wrongfully, you know, they're making them again. They're saying reimagine. They don't want to get anywhere near what the original film was. They reimagine it, and they just ruin it. You know, we've reimagined it, and we've reimagined it worse. You know, like, we've taken all the fun out of it. We're taking all the old reference. You know, we're using the film in name only, and it's just an abysmal failure. Like, one of the biggest failures, I feel, was the Lost in Space remake in the 90s. Where they took the family, Robinson and the robot, and they redesigned the robot, and they made the family all hate each other and dysfunctional. They took whatever fun and whatever spirit was in the original Irwin Allen production, and they just ground it, you know, into the dirt, and just made it a terrible, terrible, terrible movie, and probably ruined that franchise forever, because they took a really fun show and try to make it not even so much serious, but they put a hard 90s edge, dysfunctional edge on it. And I think a lot of studios do that. They'll take a really really nice property and they'll want to give it a new modern edge, which I understand if you want to maybe hold the interest of today's generation, but you don't have to make things mean-spirited and dysfunctional. For instance, you know, when they remade the Brady Bunch movies some years ago, I mean, they kept the spirit of the Brady Bunch, and they did really well. The movies made a lot of money. But when you take something that is very near and dear to a generation and you redo it, and you redo it poorly, or in a mean spirit just to make a buck or be topical, you know, it's really rejected, and it just ruins it. So just a little side note to the studios: if you're going to remake a film, you know, do it better. Pay homage to the original film. Know what you're doing, and try to go beyond the urge just to you know, make a quick dollar, and you know, make a quality project, and you know, so forth. Anyway, so that's my two cents about that.
Thanks, Fred, for being here with us on Robots.
Well, you're very welcome. Anytime.
Most of us robotics fans are sci-fi lovers, diving into futuristic stories for inspiration. That's why we want to give the winner of our celebrity robot competition this week a chance to win their favorite sci-fi movie. Just let us know on the forum who your favorite movie robot is and motivate it with text, pictures, movie snippets, or nothing. The winner will be the one who best fits our idea of a sci-fi lover.
You got that? Just follow the link on our website to post your favorite movie robot. Who's your favorite robot, Sabine?
I'd have to say Eve from WALL-E. What about yours?
To be honest, lately I've taken a liking to Caprica 6, if you really call her a robot. Anyway, that's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. And of course, don't forget to stop by the forum for discussion on today's show and other hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Be a Classic with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.